Today on the show, we're sitting down with Alyssa Fjeld and talking trilobites. This episode, we discuss why molting is like leveling up, the parallels between segmented bodies and Lego, and honorable mentions to the weirdest sea cockroaches, including Astangia, Bilobata, and its clefted butt cheeks. Pals in Paleo presents Trilobites with Alyssa Fjeld.
Let's go back.
This is Pals in Paleo, the podcast that connects you with some of the best and brightest paleontologists and their incredible work. I'm your host, paleontologist, PhD student, and fossil fanatic, Adele Pentland. You can keep up to date with the show and see cool photos of the fossils we talk about by following us on Instagram at Pals in Paleo, spelt the Aussie way, ending A-E-O. Pals in Paleo acknowledges the traditional custodians of the land throughout Australia and their connections to land, sky, all waterways, and community. We pay our respects to the elders past, present, and emerging, and extend respect to all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples today. This episode was recorded on the traditional lands of the Eastern Kulin Nations with assistance from the Conservation Department at Museums Victoria, as well as Koa Country, and fossils of trilobites are known across Australia and the world. Fossils of the trilobite Astangia bilobata are known from Kadapintinga, and we pay respects to the people of the Ramanjiri, Garanjiri, Ghana, and Bangala nations. Today's episode is all about an obscure group of invertebrates. Like, maybe you've heard of them, you know, they're called trilobites. Trilobites are, of course, a major component of the fossil record and were around for 270 million years. I'm so pumped for this conversation, which was recorded late last year. So just keep that in mind when we dive into the interview and we're talking about last year, this year, and all of that good stuff. But before we get into that, though, I wanted to give a couple of definitions for two of the technical terms that pop up during this episode. And they are lacustrine or lacustrine and morphometric. So lacustrine means something that is living in a freshwater system, kind of has the word lake in it, that's how I would remember it, and it describes the environment a fossil is from, or more accurately, the environment as indicated by the sediment surrounding it. The other word I wanted to pick apart is morphometric. Whenever I hear morphometrics, I think Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. And this is the study of, not superpowers, but form using the power of numbers to measure distances and variation. So instead of just eyeballing a fossil and trying to work out if it's different, it's actually plotting measurements on graphs and stuff like that. So just keep those terms in the back of your mind for later. They'll come in handy, I promise. The last little detour before we dive into the interview is, of course, our random fossil fact. Think of this as the last pit stop at the servo or gas station to fuel up before hitting the highway for a long drive. Podcasts like Common Descent and I Know Dino bring you the news, but here at Pals in Paleo, we're all about weird trivia. Today's random fossil fact is that the earliest written account of a trilobite was written by Edward Schloyd in 1698, who described it as, and I quote, some kind of flat fish. This is according to an article written by Dr. Mark Bell for Paleontology Online, and that piece is linked up in the show notes. So Schloyd was the second keeper of Oxford University's Ashmolean Museum, and he published the first catalogue of fossils, including the first but sadly inaccurate account of a trilobite. The fossil in question was collected from near Shandalo in South Wales and was later identified as a trilobite from the Ordovician. Trilobites are, of course, known from around the world, and there are over 20,000 species of trilobites. So this episode, we're painting with a really broad brush, but let's get the lowdown on these extinct arthropods with special guest Alyssa Fjeld. This is Pals in Paleo, the show where we talk about the form, function, and family groupings. And on today's episode, I'm not talking about vertebrates for once. I know I've been really bad lately, very biased, but today I'm talking with someone who works on invertebrates. Today we have Alyssa Fjeld.
Hello, Adele. Woo, go bugs.
Yes, we are recording on the traditional lands of the Eastern Kulin Nations with assistance from, again, the wonderful team at Museums Victoria, the Conservation Department, as well as Tim Ziegler, who is up with Paleo Department. The dust has settled on the CAVEPS conference, but I'm still trying to hit up as many paleos based in NAM in Melbourne as I can. And yeah, just slowly picking my way through the Evans Evomorph Lab at Monash University. So you're a PhD candidate there?
Yeah, so I am a PhD candidate at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia. I've been here for about a year and a half now. And before this, I was working with a group of researchers at Macquarie University, where I got my master's, where I looked at a different group of early invertebrates from the Cambrian. Here, my project is focused on early arthropods from the Cambrian and how they grow their bodies.
Evans Evomorph Lab, led by now Professor Alistair Evans.
Woo!
It's really hard not to call him Dr. Al, because I had him many moons ago. He took us for second year biology, and he was Dr. Teeth Al on Instagram. Like,
yes.
Teeth is his big thing, but it's kind of looking at this, I guess it's a math formula in a way, like the power cascade model, and just, yeah, a bunch of different researchers in your group are kind of looking at how that rule can be applied to how animals and other things in biology sort of respond to that equation.
Absolutely. With Al, I think his interest in this kind of stuff comes from on growth and form and a lot of that early research into morphometric space and growth. And the kind of not just biological or ecological constraints, but the geometric constraints on growth as well. And while the power cascade is something that we've explored in a wider group of animals, the inhibitory cascade is an older theory of Al's that came about in, I want to say, 2007. And it's something that his research group has explored a few times with different groups of vertebrate animals. It's only recently that he started to branch out and ask what other groups of animals we might be seeing this in. And the first group that he wanted to look at were arthropods, which he looked at with honor student at the time, now PhD candidate, Mark Nikolic, who with Melanie Hopkins devised an overview of trilobites and a couple of other early arthropods from the Cambrian and then throughout the history of trilobite life. And what they discovered is that, broadly speaking, these animals are following this pattern. And it's my job as a PhD student to come in and say, okay, well, if we're seeing this broad trend, what are some of the finer details that we can attribute to it? What's happening when we first look at the earliest trilobites we can look at? And then as they change and radiate out in the Cambrian, what are some of the changes we're seeing? Are they still following the pattern? When do they follow it, and when do they deviate?
Yeah. So, like, how to build a body, but I guess also, like, what invisible rules are kind of limiting stuff as well? And we should say, trilobites, they're an incredibly diverse group. There's not just one trilobite. They are absolutely tiny. And then some of the big ones that I've seen when I was browsing and looking around here at the displays at Museums Victoria, Redlechia rex, which is, I think, from Katapintinga, from Kangaroo Island.
Yeah.
It's huge. It's like, it's bigger than a dinner plate. It's big, beefy boys. And then trilobites as well, like, I cannot remember the name of it, but it has like a weird trident, like, sticking out
yes.
of its head. There was one, and I can't remember the genus name, sorry, Dr. Patrick Smith, but it has like a long tail, almost like a horseshoe crab.
Yeah.
And its species name is Excalibur. Chef's kiss. Mm. Perfect. And then, yeah, they have like different spines and stuff as well. So yeah, they're incredibly diverse. And you sort of touched on this at your poster presentation at CAVEPS as well. But like arthropods today, their body is made up of segments, but when they're little, they don't have that many. And as they molt, they'll acquire and level up, and it's like plus one extra segment. Well, maybe you can correct me on that. Is it plus one extra segment or?
For trilobites? Yes. Yes. The rule of thumb is typically as they're growing, at least in the groups I study, it's addition of one segment per mole.
That makes my video game brain really happy.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's one of the really great things about using trilobites. I mean, at CAVEPS, one of the most interesting things to me was just seeing how much vert material we do get in Australia.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been a big year because there was PDU3 as well. Woo! And it was great to kind of sit there as someone who mainly works on verts these days and see Tori Botha and so many amazing different things that can be done with early squishy life, like Yakka and Fauna.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And yeah, it was great.
And the interesting thing as well with vertebrate material is that from one piece, you can say so much about something like Jake's project with Megaraptors. It's like he's got this fragment of bone and he's able to extrapolate so much about the live animal from that. And I think with inverts, it's a little bit reversed, where the advantage is that we have lots of it.
Yeah, because they have an exoskeleton. Their heart parts are on the outside.
And just by biomass in general, most arthropods make up a pretty significant bulk of the biomass in a given ecosystem.
Yeah, I think there's a crazy stat that if aliens landed on Earth today, just by biomass, they would assume that ants are in charge.
Yeah.
We respect and praise our ant overlords.
I, for one, welcome our ant overlords.
Nailed it.
Yeah, something like 85% of the species we have on our planet today are arthropods. There's this old chestnut that goes around on social media about how one in four animals is a beetle.
Yes. Oh my gosh, I was going to say that too. I thought there was like another quote where like an early naturalist or like evolutionary biologist was saying, when God created... And I'm using air quotes a lot.
She can see it. I can see them.
When they got around to beetles, they just went ham. Like, they have a real fondness for this group.
Absolutely, yeah. And so with trilobites, one of the useful things about them is that because we have so many of them and they have so many different morphologies and they're in all of these different places, it's like... you have a lot more to work with when you're trying to figure out how they grew and what they were doing. And because they're molting as well and not just continuously growing, you can have these kind of stopwatch moments where you're saying, okay, it was a juvenile at a stage here, at a stage here, at a stage here, even if it's different specimens and we're just seeing molts. It's really useful if you want to say something about how an animal grew. And because we have so many of them, you get a lot more like statistically significant data.
Yeah.
I mean,
N does not equal one.
Yes. I mean,
big advantage.
I would love there to be 400 Pharaoh Dracos, but like
a colony. Maybe it happened.
But you're going to find it any day now.
It's hollow bones.
Yes. Yeah.
With trilobites, they have a really extensive fossil record too.
Yeah.
I mean, they're an iconic fossil. You can't say the word trilobite without thinking of paleontology and fossils.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's whenever I've tried to talk about what I do, usually trilobite is the example of like a fossil invertebrate that I go for because there's not a lot alive today that really looks like them.
There's roly-polies or like isopods or slaters of pill bugs.
Yeah.
These are all common names for the same thing. But to me, they're similar because they both roll up into a ball.
Yeah, yeah. And another fun little thing there is that the scientific name for roly-polies, I think, is something like Armadillo Dillidae.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. That does sound familiar.
It's incredibly whimsical. It's great.
Yeah, in reference to the armadillo for curling up too. Trilobites, though, you can see their little eye bumps too in the fossils, which is really cool.
Yeah, so trilobites had these incredible eyes that morphologically you'll see them in all kinds of different places on different species. Sometimes they're not present in the species lineage at all, like agnostids. But then in some of them, you'll get really, really large, well-developed eyes.
And some of them have eyes on stalks. Is that
okay? I don't think they're on, some of them are elevated, but I don't think they're on stalks. I'd love there to be. Pat Smith, please email me your stalked trilobite eyes.
I don't think I'm probably just confusing something.
But it's cool because with trilobite eyes, they're some of the first complex eyes to have evolved. And it's hypothesized that by the Silurian, some of these species were able to see quite well.
Silurian, is that like around 300 something million years ago?
Yeah.
443.8 to 419 million years ago, give or take. So a little bit older than 300 mil. Glad I fact checked that IRL. So when you say complex eyes, these are compound eyes?
Yeah, and they come in three different primary arrangements that we see in trilobites. I'm going to butcher the pronunciation of them terribly, but I'm going
to... This is your podcast. Also, just with while you're doing that, with compound eyes, so they're not eyes like humans have. They're made out of many hexagonal lenses.
Yes. And in the case of trilobites, they're actually made of calcite.
Oh, yes. Calcite is a really funky mineral. And the way you ID calcite, well, it's kind of like a blocky grain, kind of could be mistaken for quartz, unless the really cool thing you do is if you have something written down or a picture, if you put a chunk of calcite over it, it like splits the image in two.
Yeah.
That's the best way I can describe that.
Yeah. And it's a little bit like if somebody took quartz and smeared it a little. It's a bit like cattywampus.
Yeah. It's like a parallelogram. Is that that shape?
Yeah. Okay. So there are three trilobite eye types: holocroal, schizocroal, and a bathocroal. And that's just describing the distancing between the different lenses. So in holocroal eyes, they're just right next to each other.
Yep.
Then in the schizocroal eyes, there's a sclera. There's a thick sclera that kind of bounds between the lenses.
A sclera, is that like just a body plate?
It's like a gooey meat thing.
Oh, it's goo. Okay. Oh, no, I'm thinking of sclerites.
Yes.
That's what that is. Okay.
No, there's surprising amounts of goo in the trilobite world. We just don't usually see it.
Well, it doesn't fossilize that well,
no.
I suppose. So, okay, so goo in between lenses.
Yeah.
And then the third type of eye?
It's a like shallow lens with really small borders of that sclera. So it's not as chunky. And we only really see those in the eodiscids from the Cambrian. So it's a style of eye making that kind of went out of fashion.
Old fashioned. Yeah. Okay. So in terms of which trilobites have the best sight, what group would that be? I'm going to say maybe not the last one because like they were selected against. RIP, pull one out, not here with us today, although none of them are.
No, sadly.
When did they go extinct? End Cretaceous?
Permian.
Permian. Oh, yeah. Earlier. Yeah, okay.
Victims of one of the big dyes.
Well, that was like the biggest mass extinction. So I guess if anything was going to take them out, it would be end Permian mass extinction when it was like something nuts, over 90% of life.
Yeah.
Depending on how you split it, whether it's just marine, just terrestrial, both.
Yeah.
Like the great dying. Life was nearly completely wiped out.
It was having a struggle.
It was not having a good time.
Yeah, so 250 million years of trilobites. They really radiated out and had their heyday kind of in the Cambrian and the Ordovician. By the time you get past the Silurian, it really bottlenecks until you're just looking at one family. So they were kind of on their last legs anyways.
But they have many legs.
They have so many
probably
legs.
Probably would have been an advantage. And I should have said at the start as well, trilobites just live in the ocean. Hey.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty sure there were no lacustrine ones. There were lacustrine eurypterids, the giant sea scorpions.
Oh, yeah.
The really big ones, actually. Some of them were actually freshwater.
Yeah.
Which is horrifying.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Because some of them are as like big as a person. I'll eventually get around to doing an episode on eurypterids, sea scorpions. But yeah, I'm very thankful that they're not around today because the idea of them being in a freshwater environment is terrifying.
We already have crocodiles. That's enough.
Australia would definitely have eurypterids and they'd be doing something crazy. So I will circle back to like trilobites and maybe we can talk about some specific examples. You're doing a PhD now though.
Yeah.
As people would have probably picked up from your accent, you're American.
Unfortunately, and I am sorry.
Pals and Paleo will be right back. This episode is brought to you by Dinosaur Trips. Dinosaur trips are exactly what they sound like. Each itinerary gets you up close and personal with experts and gives you backstage access into the world of paleontology, visiting museums from across the world, and even getting you onto real life dinosaur digs. There's a bunch of trips running in 2024. Alberta Badlands and Beyond is back, and so's Badlands Family Adventure. Personally, I'm eyeing off the trip to Arizona and California because I'm dying to see the La Brea tar pits, but then again, I'm also tempted to travel to Patagonia. To learn more about the 2024 trips, you can check out their website, dinosaurtrips.com, and sign up to their newsletter to be the first to find out about the new trips. And you can email Zach on zach@dinosaurtrips.com, and Zach is spelled Z-A-C-H. It's been 66 million years. Why wait any longer? Join Dinosaur Trips on the adventure of a lifetime.
we cannot help who we are. What has the path into paleontology sort of been like? Did you have in your head when you were a kid that you wanted to be a paleontologist? Or
I think growing up, it was a case of like, I was just really interested in everything. I was outside a lot. I did a lot of like summer camps and things like that. And I grew up kind of in the Appalachian Mountains in East Tennessee. I don't often sound like it. I can if it suits. But one of the advantages to being outside a lot and in that environment is that Appalachia is this tremendous chain of mountains that has been eroded down for hundreds of millions of years. And a lot of the deposits in it contain fossils. Some of them are like lepidodendrons and different carboniferous trees and plant material. But the ones I was always interested in were like the early marine sediments that we would get from the Silurian. I was really interested in that kind of stuff, partially because, you know, at 5 or 6, you can't really differentiate. And I thought all of it was dinosaurs.
I mean, honestly, though, in the public exhibitions, a lot of parents are just kind of calling everything dinosaurs as well. So, and I'm not mad about it either.
Yeah.
It's just the nature of the thing. Yeah,
absolutely. But it was a case of I would find a cool fossil and I would show somebody and they'd be like, well, actually, that's a plant. And it started me on this journey of here's a cool thing I found in nature, a cool rock, a cool fossil, a cool mineral. And I can show it to people and have a talk about it and learn something cool about where I live. And then I got older and far nerdier and I really min-maxed my stats for just getting the grades. And the American school system, sometimes it's about all you can do.
Yeah. And I think from what I've seen, your system's like a little bit different to here because there's also like a big emphasis on extracurricular activities and volunteering and I guess being a member of the community.
Yeah.
Which I think kind of makes you like a bit of a more well-rounded, better person rather than just like my high school experience was just studying all the time and pulling back from getting outside and exercising and moving my body and we got through it. It's fine.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the reasons I think I came to college and I was very much in that sci-fi headspace of like, I want to do astronomy and I want to look at stuff on other planets. And then I took physics and it was like, maybe not.
This was my worst subject as well. And then the school system in America and with college and stuff is different because like your first year, you sort of have a breadth of subjects because here in Australia, it's like you're doing a Bachelor of Science.
Yes.
You're going to do the sciences. You can have one elective. But my experience at Monash when I did my undergrad was like chem, bio. We had to do stats. We had to do a maths. That was required. And then I ended up doing geology.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
For undergrad, they set it up so that your undergrad units only add up to about an hour short of the total. And then they have all these fun electives you can take. Hmm. I took Conan to Cthulhu, a history of science fiction writing.
Oh my gosh.
I really wish I'd taken Star Wars and the Roman Empire, though. That was a much better unit.
I'm glad they both exist, to be honest.
I know. I mean, it was so much fun. And then in my second year, I took a geology class and I was like, oh, I can still do science, but I go outside now. This is great. Sign me up. And that was kind of it for me. It was just geo and bio. And I kind of realized in like the third year that my interest was really in paleo.
Yeah.
And as much as I enjoy paleo, even at the time, it was a case of this is Tennessee. There's no money going into this field. At the time, there weren't really even people who could have supervised a PhD in it.
Wow.
It would have been a case of either paying a lot of money to go to somewhere like Duke or going out of state or going through the process of field camp and doing some of the additional things you do in the US to get into a PhD program in paleo.
Yeah. Or I guess doing an internship and making those connections.
You can do an internship, but most of the universities want you to do at least 6 weeks of field camp, field study. Okay.
Yeah, right. Well, there's financial costs as well.
Yeah.
And like, we should also acknowledge that that is like genuinely a barrier. It's a barrier for people to do paleo in Australia too, even though there's the HECS debt system or whatever it's called now, you have fees and stuff, but there are people who would love to do it and they can't. They have to feed their families or feed themselves. So
yeah. And I mean, it's also a case of I really wanted to do big cats. That was the thing I wanted to do my PhD on. I wanted to look at the way that the expansion of big cats and then smilodons and the competition kind of went in South America. And I got told at the time, like, look, if you want to do this field, you're going to have to go to these schools and you're going to need to have much better grades than you have. And I'd been in school for so long, I felt really burnt out. And I decided to take a little break from academia and decide whether or not paleo was really worth it to me, because it sounded like trying to pursue this was going to be something that was going to be difficult And it was something that wasn't going to make a lot of money. And it was something that was going to displace me. So
yeah,
a case of, like, as you know, with paleo, to pursue our research, we move around a lot.
It's really rare for someone to sort of have done their undergrad, done their PhD, and be employed all at the one uni.
Yeah.
They're unicorns. Dr. Aaron Kamens, you're now a unicorn. but yeah, it's normally like the best case scenario is a 3-year long contract with one uni, but then, you know, that finishes and then you've got to go through and do it all over again.
Yeah.
I
mean, and it's good in a way because as a researcher, you want to get exposed to as many different kinds of styles of supervision and projects as you can.
Yeah. And see different labs too, see different collections, see how different people do it. And, you know, what better way to meet people than be like, hi, I'm your new office mate.
Yeah, absolutely. So I ended up taking 2 years away from academia. I moved to Japan where I taught English. And initially I'd signed on for it thinking, okay, this is just going to be a little break while I sort myself out. I'm 6,000 whatever miles away from home. The rocks can't reach me here.
Yeah. I'll be in a big city, you know, with all these people and stuff. Hard reset.
Yeah. And then the school that picked me up was like, oh, she's a geologist. We partner with a local geopark and we supervise students at our high school that do scientific research. And we want somebody who has the background to do that, to supervise these students so they can give them the best advice. And I was like, I'm not the person to give them the best advice. What are you talking about? I was so, so insecure. And it turned out to just be this incredible experience where the kids were learning from me and I was learning from them. And it was kind of this begrudging moment surrounded by my friends I made in Japan where it was like, Alyssa, you like the fossils, don't you? You want to study them, don't you? And it's like, yeah,
dang it.
Yeah, it's hard. You can turn your back on who you truly are, but it does come back. Even if you're just like, no, this isn't practical. This isn't sensible. This isn't what I set out to be. This isn't what I thought my life would be like. You can try and swim upriver all you want, or you can just go with the flow.
I like paleo. I like everything about it. I like the silly hours that we spend in the lab imaging stuff. I like the part where you hit the rock with the hammer really hard. I like hearing other people tell me about their paleo. And as much as I tried to deny it or find something else that I was interested in, I do think it's something that has kind of been a thread through my life. So I did what I think most people do in my position. And I talked to the other people around me in Japan and I was like, okay, I don't think the US system works for me, but I also feel like I'm a big redneck and everybody outside of the US is immediately going to pick up on the fact that I'm a podunk nobody. What do you recommend? And they were like, just apply.
Yeah.
How can you assume that people are going to look down on you if you don't even try? So I looked up all of the universities in Western countries that I thought would have a program I was interested in, and I emailed all of them.
It takes a lot of energy, though, just to get to that point, to like look into it, but then also hit send on those emails and stuff, too, because it's terrifying to just be like, can't wait to get those rejection emails.
Mm-hmm.
And they will come, but it's a numbers game as well.
Yeah. I mean, and it's a case of self-doubt as well, because until that point when you get accepted into an institution, there is this element of maybe I'm just not good enough.
Yeah. And like I experienced this too, and you heard this as well, your grades aren't good enough. But you just need one person to be like, all right, I'll give you a shot. And it's just like, okay, there's nothing wrong with me. Like, I can do this. Like, they have faith in me. Like, I'm going to back myself too.
Yeah.
So is that how you ended up at Macquarie or?
Yeah. I guess it's very silly. I had emailed, Monash was a school that I was really interested in, but they never got back to me. And when I emailed Macquarie right after that, I had made the mistake of copying the text for the email into the subject line.
We've all done it. We've all done it. So, especially if you're just in that mode of, I'm going to write a bunch of emails and stuff, but they're all very similar. You're asking the same thing, but to slightly different people. Sometimes you control C and you control V and then you just hit send and you're like, oops, it's gone.
Yeah. And it was, I don't know if that's why Matt Kosnick replied to me, but he was the university researcher that got back to me. And we had this, I still have it screenshotted as like a little keepsake, but it's like, he brought me into the Macquarie research group. He's talking about different researchers I can meet. It's like this 30 email chain, but the title is just
Here's the thing, though, and Reddit is just powered by this, though. Sometimes people will reply to you quickly because they might want to correct you.
Yes.
Not that I'm suggesting that happened, but I know it's a thing. And sometimes, like iNaturalist, chuck something up with completely the wrong ID. And it's like, I'm going to know what this is in 24 hours now. Things worked out.
Yeah.
Like, that was not make or break. It's not like they saw, this is the wrong thing and didn't open it or anything like that.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes you can make a silly mistake and it works out and it's totally fine. And
I think that's a good litmus test too, because if someone is going to be that way and just not open because someone made a simple, honest mistake, then it's just like, well, do you want to be working with them for 3 years or two years? Think about it.
Yeah. And I felt really lucky to have come to Macquarie when I did. After Japan, there was a little gap. I did this internship with the National Park System while I was waiting to hear back from Macquarie. And when I finally got...
Wait, National Park System in Australia or in Japan?
In US. I went back home.
Yep.
Sorry. So I left Japan in 2018. And then there was kind of a year where I was waiting to hear back and see who would take me. And while I was doing that, I decided to keep my hands busy. And I did a little independent project with one of my supervisors from my undergraduate degree, Dr. Jeremy Bramblett, where we just looked at some deposits nobody looked at before, trying to see if we could find some early agnathans. And then I did this internship with the National Park.
Are they a type of trilobite?
They are a type of early jawless fish.
Oh, okay.
Sorry.
Completely wrong.
Sorry.
My bad.
No, it's fine. I'm just generally really interested in weird sea beasts, so I bounce around a lot.
Yeah. I mean, also you mentioned wanting to do space and stuff.
Yeah.
Space and the deep abyssal ocean, same energy,
right?
Same vibe.
That's exactly what I like about it. It's
weird.
Yeah. The Cambrian to me is the closest we're ever going to get to space aliens.
Yeah.
And the Ediacaran as well. But personally, I struggle with Ediacaran animals because to me, they look like gummy snacks. And I get an overwhelming urge to just eat them.
I will not unsee it now. Oh, well, now I'm peckish. That's okay.
Yeah. Naturalist Fruit Snack Company, please get back to me about making Ediacaran font. I want a Spriginia gummy snack, please.
Oh my gosh. Yes. Make it happen. Dickinsonia is perfect as well. So many things.
Yeah, sorry.
Where were we on this tangent?
So I got to Australia.
Yes. Early jawless fishes.
Yes. And then I did this internship with the National Park Service where I was doing site monitoring.
Yep.
And that was really, really interesting. I think there's a lot of questions to be asked about how we look after fossil sites, who looks after them, how we connect to the community. And then I returned from that sojourn and I got shipped off to Australia in January of 2020.
Oh, what a great time to be alive and going overseas, being like, will I be able to come back?
I was so excited to explore Australia. And it turned out to be, a mixed bag, but it was advantageous because it was the last year that my supervisor, Glenn Brock, was taking new students.
Oh, okay. So you got in at a good time? Question mark?
Question mark. Asterisk on thesis.
Sorry to cut you off.
Oh, no.
For people who are doing science-based research projects, starting at that time was super stressful because you want to start your project, you need to get into the lab.
Yeah.
The uni is locked down and not accepting visitors.
Yeah.
So what do you do?
I was really fortunate to be able to do this project with Glenn and my other supervisor, Jiliang Zhang. Big shout out to Jiliang. He's so great. Okay, so back in 2016, as part of a different student's thesis, Marissa Betts.
Oh, whoa.
Yeah.
This is a legend.
She's the scientist I want to be. She's so cool. Part of her work with her thesis has been this multi-proxy approach to correlating different layers in the Cambrian.
So multi-proxy, different ways of, different methods.
Yeah, different methods of getting ages for different formations. Things like geochronology, using rocks and rare earth elements to date things, using tuff beds when we have them. But also
being a volcanic ash layer. And I guess all of it just kind of boils down to shooting lasers at things to get fractions out of rocks to tell you how old they are.
It's so cool.
That's my shorthand way of explaining it.
Yeah. And one of the other methods that she used was this correlation between small shelly faunas. So essentially during the Cambrian, we get all of these little guys who are teeny tiny, maybe about maximum size a centimeter to so small that you really want to use a microscope to kind of look at them.
Oh, okay. So not quite super, super small, but yeah, getting really close.
Yeah, not microfossil necessarily, but I call them teeny weeny fossils. And she had collected a bunch of them in order to establish different faunal zones. But the material had just been sitting in this collection throughout the pandemic. And what I did was go through it in order to do this kind of small-scale morphological analysis of different fauna within the small shelly group to say some more about how they relate to one another.
Yeah, so it was kind of group them together.
Yeah, or split them apart.
I'm trying to like get a picture in my head of what this looks like. So were there just like big chunks of rock just with matrix in between and shellies, or were there just like heaps of vials of shellies?
Ah, okay. So
like, did they need to be prepped as part of like what you were doing or?
So with small shellies, as a quick little detour for people who might not know how we process the rock, we come back from the field with all of these sacks of material that we collect along a transect. Depending on the transect, we might get them every meter, every 5 meters, every 10, or just when we have beds. We get a potato-sized chunk of rock. That is how I was told to look at it, a potato-sized chunk.
It's very specific.
I know. And then I'm like, Yukon or, you know.
Sweet potato.
There's some sizes.
Red chat.
So we come back with our chunks in our bags and we take them to this beautiful acid processing facility underneath Macquarie that is sadly no longer really being utilized. Please utilize it. Please bring us some fossils. And we process them out in these acid baths that take somewhere between a couple of weeks and a couple of days, depending on how dense the matrix is. This is a process that we kind of have to be picky with because it'll destroy any of the calcareous fossils like trilobites.
Right.
But it preserves the stuff like the small shelly fossils, which are usually a little bit more phosphatic.
Oh, okay.
And then we put all of these little small shellies and the detritus that didn't dissolve away. We sort it using centrifugal methods, or we just pick it by hand.
So centrifugal, that would be like putting them somewhere and then getting something to whiz them around like a carnival ride. And then the lighter stuff will fling off first.
Yeah.
And then the heavier stuff will be left at the end.
Yeah. With the small shellies, some of them that we look for now, we're realizing are so fragile that this method's actually quite bad for them. So a lot of this was handpicked as well. Bless Marissa for doing that work. And instead of in vials, we keep them in these little trays that have round wells. So usually three little round wells in a glass covering. And they're labeled by stratigraphic section. So where we are in the rock record and where we are on a specific transect.
Keeping a hold of your data is very important.
Especially when they're that little, because you are never more than one sneeze away from confusion.
Oh, that is a very good point.
And for Glenn's information, that never happened to me ever. Definitely.
I worked on amber for my honors project and tiny pieces. Most of mine were 1 mil grain size and I would pick them with just a pair of tweezers and stuff. But there were times when something would go on the floor and I'd be in an office chair and I'd be like, check underneath you, check all six legs before I move to then be like, can I retrieve this or is this gone forever?
Yeah. So I was just looking through the stuff that was already in these little wells. And what I was trying to do essentially was determine whether or not this group called Timotids is actually a group or if it needs to be split up. And it's a pet theory that a lot of people like Christian Skovsted, Glenn Brock, Marissa, Topper, the big Cambrian boys have had this in mind for a while, that it's probably not really a group. It's just they're making similar looking ornament.
Oh, so it's like paraphyletic.
Yes.
So yeah, they're not genuinely all related to one another.
Yeah.
They're just all looking real similar to each other.
They just all wore pink on Wednesday.
Yeah. Okay, great.
Yeah. And what we did to try and make that determination was we did a bunch of laser stuff, which was a lot of fun. Essentially, we took really high magnification images of the exterior of the animal to see what the micro ornament is. So if you think about like the spikes on the trilobite, that's an ornament.
Yes.
Or if you think about like the scutes on a croc, that's an ornament. But the little divots and the pits and the texture of it, that's a micro ornament. And by looking at that and then doing the process where you put them in the resin and then you slowly file away the surface of the fossil until you can see the interior, We then looked at something called ultrastructure, which tells us about how the shell is being built.
So if someone pictures like an ammonite and it's cut, it'd be like looking at the chambers and the shapes of the chambers, because the sutures, the things that separate each chamber, they're really diagnostic for that group.
Exactly. And this is something that had only been really looked at before by one researcher. And it was a little bit of a footnote in a more expansive article. And he did excellent work, not to dismiss what Balthazar did at all, but it was just a little bit more to build on it. And then we also tried to do a little bit of elemental analysis, which is really fun. I loved running those scans because they take 6 hours and you can watch so much TV while they run. I mean, you can write your thesis while they run. And I was really lucky as well during that time because I got to do all this field work. When we would have these breaks in the lockdowns in New South Wales, we would go to South Australia and I would get to work with not just the people who were doing what I was doing, but the trilobite researchers as well. And that was kind of when I got introduced to John Patterson and Jimmy Holmes. And it was like, yeah, I understand why arthropods are really cool now. It's a lot of fun to look for them. And when you find them, they're so complex and they're so, they look so much more like an animal we could imagine today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's nice and immediate. And John Patterson is one of your supervisors on your project now?
Yeah, I'm supervised by Alistair Evans, Justin Adams, James Holmes, and John Patterson. I'm leaving the titles out because I always mess them up when I try to say them out loud, but
they're all at least doctors.
Yes, they're all doctors.
Not higher.
Yeah. Justin and Al are at Monash, and John and Jimmy are both at UNE.
You've talked about the brief periods of reprieve and obviously making those really important connections, but how was it trying to do a thesis during the chaos of the pandemic?
You know, I think it was actually really good to have something
to keep you busy.
Yeah, like at the time, I didn't really think about it, but if I had known the pandemic was
going to be that long.
Yeah, I was grateful to be in Australia for it instead of in Tennessee where we had really bad case numbers. But it was also like, okay, I am stuck at home, but I'm in a really beautiful city and I have a cool project to motivate me to get out of bed every day. Because if I hadn't had that, 1,000% would have just been in bed on my Switch playing Stardew Valley. This was something that was motivating and it was something that made me feel like I had a purpose.
Yeah. And I think it would have also had you connected with other people too, because presumably everyone in your lab as well was kind of keeping tabs on you and you were still having meetings with supervisors to check on how you were going, both in terms of the project and how you're going as a person. Because we have one brain at the end of the day. And if your mental health isn't going good, it's hard to do your best work.
Yeah, for sure. I was still very much in this mode of, ooh, my supervisor, he's so much smarter and more accomplished than me. How do I even tell him that I need a little vacation? And it was a process of kind of, I guess, learning the hard way that you can trust your supervisors and you can trust your lab mates to have your back, not just with projects, but with being a healthy, well-rounded person. We would go on walks as a cohort and things like that. Not the people necessarily in my lab, but other people that were doing their masters at the same time. We would check in on each other. We'd go for walks. We would make some time to just watch a movie on Discord or something.
Yeah, it's really important, those connections that you make, because those people are your peers and stuff.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd like to think that if you saw a cool job that someone who was in your lab is perfectly suited towards, you'd like to think you'd flick that off to them and they'd do the same for you.
Yeah. From what I've seen in my experiences in Australia, the environment among other paleontologists is so supportive and the networking is so open and so friendly. I've never felt like I've encountered somebody in the field here that genuinely didn't wish other people success or wasn't ready to extend a job that they thought another person was more qualified for or help them with a part of their project. And I think that's true for my current lab as well. Among the variety of things that we all study, just how willing everybody is to help each other and contribute. It's really amazing just how many people there are in the paleo community in Australia now that we can learn from and learn from each other.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I'm guessing you still keep in touch with folks from Macquarie as well? Because like, when did you finish your master's?
I turned it in, I want to say, October or November of 2021, and I finished revisions in March 2022.
Yeah.
But I definitely still keep up with everyone. One of the people in my cohort, Ailey McKenzie, has continued. She's doing her PhD on, I think, modern snake species.
Oh, cool.
She's so talented as an artist and as a scientist. She's done all of this amazing work. She's with the Australian Museum in Sydney now. Jack Jones, another student who's working on his PhD at the moment with Glenn, he's Glenn's last student.
Well, if they're anything like one of my supervisors, Pat Rich, she's had a few law students. She was not going to take any more PhDs when I was an undergrad.
I mean, I hope that Glenn stays in the game. He's an incredibly talented researcher and there's so much we can learn from him. But it's also like, he should go rest. He should go spend time with his family. But it's very chief of police and it's his last day. He's one day away from retirement and then a big case lands in their lap. It's, they keep dragging me back in.
Yeah, a fun world to be part of.
Yeah.
So you finished at Macquarie and then did you know you wanted to go over to Monash and like move to Melbourne or like how did that come about?
When I was first trying to decide if I wanted to stay in paleo in 2018, I still remember it. I was chatting with my partner at the time who was from Australia and he had talked so much about how wonderful Melbourne is as a city and just the things that he liked about it. And I thought, yeah, you know, that does sound really good. And I started looking at Monash then because there were so many interesting departments and they had so much research in paleo that seemed really interesting at the time. And I guess to me, doing the master's was a pathway to get to Monash because it just sounded like the perfect school and the best environment. And it's a bit roundabout. I knew somebody at Macquarie who was in the geology department who had come back to Melbourne to work at the synchrotron. Shout out to Andrew Langendam.
Oh, yeah. Andrew was a demo for me in undergrad.
Yeah.
He's a legend.
Langers is great. Yeah. He knew Al and he said to me that Al was looking for an invert person for a PhD project. And I said, I'm invert people. I can do that.
That's me.
Yeah, it's me. So Andrew put me in touch with Al and we chatted a few times. I came down to Melbourne in February of last year and kind of met the lab. I was fortunate enough to meet Talia before she graduated.
Talia Pollock.
We miss Talia so much. Come back, Talia.
Because she did like a lot of great work on Tassie Devils.
Big cats.
Big cats.
I know. Oh. It was the research I wanted to. Oh, she was so cool. And Al was great. I met Kate and I thought, yeah, this is me. This is, I want to be here. I put in the application for Monash after I got my revisions turned in. And I remember I was actually back home visiting my family at the time when the confirmation that I had been accepted came through.
Oh, that would have been so special.
It was just so heartwarming to actually be able to run up to my parents. I mean, it was 11 o'clock at night and they were asleep. But like I ran in and I was like, Mom, Dad, I got in. I got into the PhD. And they were like, oh, yes, good.
Okay, back to sleep now. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah, it's a stressful time too, because I remember when I was waiting to hear from Swinburne University when I was first there, and I was counting down the days. Like they said, it takes between 6 to 8 weeks. On like 8 weeks on the dot, I was drafting that email to be like,
yeah,
what's the deal? And then just the relief of like, oh, I have certainty now. Like, I know what I'm going to be doing for the rest of my life and I can really begin. Because I think at that point, I was reading, I was doing background stuff because I'm like, I'm going to hit the ground running. I'm going to go after this. But your motivation is a bit janky sometimes when it's just like, will I? Won't I?
Yeah.
Is this a waste of time? Could I be playing Tears of the Kingdom?
Yeah.
Or Breath of the Wild as it was back then?
And I think it's a normal part of the process. But I also think that it's an incredibly isolating experience because every time you're that person going through it, it's like, yeah, but I know my friends are successful, smart, beautiful people. I might not be. Maybe it's me and I'll be the one that they finally go, yeah, no, science isn't for you. But no, it was really amazing to get in. And Melbourne's just been, it hasn't been everything that I thought it would be in terms of like the weather.
Yeah. If you're not familiar with weather, there is a very famous Crowded House song called Four Seasons in One Day. And if you don't like the weather, don't worry. In 20 minutes, it'll change again.
Yeah, I did not know how many sweaters I needed to wear in winter here.
Oh, I still don't some days. I just like wear layers. And then, like I said to you this morning, I had my jacket on, did some walking, and I'm like, great, now I'm hot and I want to take my tights off.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
But no, seriously, Melbourne and Monash have been these incredible opportunities. And it just feels like, yeah, like you said, it's kind of, this is what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. This is where I want to be. This is what I like to do. These are my weird little bugs.
So to circle back again to your project, you're not someone who's just working on one kind of group as well because of this power cascade approach to looking at the fossils. This is the lens, essentially.
Yeah. So I guess for people who might not be familiar with what the inhibitory cascade is, essentially it's a pattern that describes the relationship between the way the different segments grow. And if you think about segments as Lego and the way that you would build any tower structure using basic building blocks, you can start to see different repetitive patterns in the way that those blocks get generated. And the inhibitory cascade is essentially saying, if you have the initial generation of a segment, the animal makes a molar. The subsequent molars that grow in are going to be inhibited or affected by the way that first one grew and the size that one grew to. So when we see the inhibitory cascade in animals, essentially what we're seeing is this linear relationship of growth of the area of a segment.
Yeah. So, it's like, just to cut in, I just thought of a really good analogy. Have you seen the meme of like a cake, right? And rather than taking a nice wedge shape out the side, someone cuts like a perfect rectangle in the center of it. Have you seen that?
Yes.
Would you say the inhibitory cascade is that situation with the cake?
Why not? Okay. Alistair, you can correct me later. But yeah, you're just taking kind of a shortcut to do it the most efficient way possible to make it suited to the structure's purpose, basically. Yeah.
There's a domino effect in building blocks, essentially.
Yeah.
One affects everything else.
And it's something that if you put it on a graph, it makes a straight line, or it makes a line that is straight, and then there's some kind of inflection point and it changes shape or it changes slope. And there's all this other math you can do about it, but that's really all that we're looking at, is just to see whether or not when we look at a fossil, even if we can't see how that animal generated a segment, we can see its molt series and we can say, okay, this segment is yay much bigger than this segment, and so on. If we put it on a graph, does it make a line?
Yeah. I guess you could unconsciously kind of do this as well. Like if you found, I don't know, part of a trilobite, you could probably draw roughly what the rest of the animal looked like because you kind of know what pattern follows.
Most of the time, that's absolutely, yeah. We get some weirdos in the fossil record, like Balcarina, which it starts out doing normal trilobite things, and then it has like the world's longest, skinniest butt. And
oh.
It's, or Kleptothule, which is like, what if we made a trilobite millipede?
They told me I could be anything, so I became a millipede.
Yeah. I, for one, am going to become a crab. That's my ultimate goal. But we're starting with trilobites because, like I was saying before, they're a great model study species because they're prolific.
Big sample size to pull from.
Yeah, especially with the sample size that we're using for the model that I'm using to establish methodology. So before we do anything else, we have to make sure that we know how we're going to do the measurements.
Yeah.
And that we're doing it as accurately as possible. So I'm using this data set of Asangia bilobata trilobites from South Australia as the starting point because there are 200 of them and we have them from the ittiest, bittiest little calcified juvenile to the full honking adult.
Are they Cambrian?
Yeah, they are early stage 2 Cambrian trilobites from the Emu Bay Shale.
Oh, awesome. So yeah, again, Kangaroo Island, Cardiff and Tinker.
Yeah, awesome. But we're hoping that once we get that method kind of established with these guys, we can go, okay, well, this is how we're going to do the measurements. And then we're going to just broaden out to the rest of the trilobites in the phylogeny that John Patterson talks about in his 2019 paper, which is one of the most recent revisions of trilobite orders and families, all in big air quotes there, because we still struggle to see how they relate. But this is the most definitive. This is how this relates. And this is when we see it. Once we know how to measure them, then we can start to see whether or not there are changes to the pattern and deviations as we look at these different families. But really, my ultimate goal as a big Anomalocaris fangirl is to broaden out to the other early arthropods and archaeopods and see whether or not animals other than trilobites have this pattern. And if they do, are they doing similar stuff?
Yeah, it'd be crazy to see if something as relatively big for its size, Anomalocaris, which we talked about in episode 1, if it's doing this, because its frontal appendages, its face fangs, as I used to call them and will still call them.
Yes.
They're made out of segments as well, aren't they? Because
yeah.
They flex and move and stuff. So yeah, there's so many broad applications and ways of looking at, again, what you're doing, which is looking at a range of different animals and stuff and little yearlings to like big grandma trilobite, but also just zooming in on one part of the body and being like, right, how is the inhibitory cascade influencing all this stuff?
Yeah.
Because those frontal appendages also have spines too.
Yes.
So there's a lot going on.
It's really incredible. Well, as you talked about in the Hallucigenia episode, a limb is a limb is a limb when you come to a segmented arthropod or a segmented worm.
Copy paste.
Yeah, except the front bit, because
yes.
That's the one that they begin to specialize to do different stuff.
Yeah.
And that's the really incredible thing about early Cambrian arthropods is it's one of the first groups to go, what if we did that? I mean, Hallucigenia and some of the other early animals, like the armored worms, were doing it too. But that's one of the things that is worth looking at when we talk about segmenting patterns is, okay, this is one of the first groups to start specializing their appendages. Do we see the inhibitory cascade present as you would normally see it?
As you would expect to see it.
Yeah. Or do we see that it's being constrained because there are different morphological and environmental factors controlling what this limb needs to do? And the frontal appendages for these different dinocarids and radiodonts, so the group that contains Anomalocaris and then a whole bunch of other weirdos with snabbly face meats and...
Opabinio?
Yeah.
Radiodont, that's like wheel face.
Yeah, it's the mouth on the bottom part that no longer...
Circle of Doom.
Yeah, the Circle of Doom for worms, not trilobites.
Yeah, actually, what kind of face does a trilobite have? Because I don't know if I know. Because, you know, you draw the head, you see them a lot of the time, like top-down view.
Yeah.
I don't know if I really ever see them the other way.
Yeah, we don't often see them preserved in that view, mostly just because of their life habits. Or...
Yeah, so they're like running around on the seafloor anyway in that position. So then when they get fossilized, they just get buried.
Yeah, if we have free-swimming ones, typically they're just...
There are free-swimming trilobites?
At least for some parts of their life cycle.
Oh, okay.
Not like all the time out there just hanging out. Okay. But like,
I mean, it was an eye-opener when someone showed me like a clam swimming. Just by opening and closing its shell. I was like, what?
I know. Or like how many eyes scallops have. That was a horrible discovery and I encourage no one to Google it.
I will follow your advice.
So when we do see the underside of trilobites, the face essentially wraps all the way around to the bottom. So you have the eyes on the top.
So kind of like a cockroach situation?
Yeah, the cockroaches of the sea.
My husband, ages ago, he was like, we were messaging and he was just like, sea cockroaches, what are they called? I'm like, do you mean trilobites? He's like, yes. And I'm like, Harry, you what? Anyway, sea cockroaches.
Yeah.
My husband was right. He's often right. It's very infuriating. Anyway.
So they have the eyes on the top, and it's usually to either side of this organ called a glabella, which is this lobe boy that its purpose is maybe digestive, maybe... correct me if I'm wrong on that, trilobite people. I think we don't really know what the glabella fully does.
It's contentious.
Yes.
A few things have been suggested by the sounds of it. Let's just run with that.
Yeah. And then on the underside, once you kind of come over the top of the cephalon and you're on the underside, there's usually a little disarticulated sclerite or a hard part of the skeleton that's not attached that's called a hypostome. And the hypostome is theorized to have been a covering for the mouth part for most trilobites. So something that would have allowed them to help get food in. And then the mouth would have been right near the hypostome, either underneath it or kind of eclipsed by it.
So the eyes are on the top to keep an eye on predators that are swimming around or just coming up behind them and stuff. Because trilobites, some ate each other as well. Hey?
Yes, yes.
Trilobite cannibalism. Wild.
You hate to see it.
And then, their mouths on the other side so that if they, in their very slow car chase, catch up on another one, they can start eating it as well. Are they all eating other animals?
Some of them may have been durophages. I think there's a little bit of evidence for...
So eating, able to eat crunchy things.
Yes. Yeah. So there's a little bit of evidence that they may have eaten certain kinds of ostracods at different points in their history.
Okay, so ostracods being like small crustaceans. They're very famous because the males of the species have a organ that is longer than their body.
I mean, props to them, but...
Happy for them. Someone had to do it.
Yeah,
I guess. And there's quite a lot of them in the sea, too.
Yeah. So I think the idea typically is, and we don't have a lot of evidence for how trilobites ate or what they ate. Out of the 20,000-something samples that we have, we only have about 21 samples with preserved gut material.
How unlucky do you have to be? That's wild.
It's so frustrating.
Is it just because there's a lot sitting in collections and we haven't had the technology to double check
that
they have gut contents?
That is what I tell myself when I go to sleep at night.
Yeah,
and I dream
would like
of it.
To think that.
I would love to be the person that makes some definitive determination because trilobites are so iconic and we've known about them for so long. I mean, there are samples in museums from the 1800s. Who's imaging these boys? Let's find out. But we have been getting more in recent years. There's a paper coming out next year at some point that John Patterson's worked on with soft-bodied anatomy and trilobites that's hopefully going to have some answers there. But yeah, I think most of the time trilobites were eating other things that were a little bit, their exoskeletons wouldn't have been as tough as theirs. So trilobites have relatively relatively thick exoskeletons compared to other arthropods, even during the time period.
Yep. And that's made out of, yeah, calcium carbonate, but a little bit of like phosphate as well to make it tough. Yep.
Typically, it depends on where you're looking and what formation. In the Kangaroo Island formation, there's a couple of different preservation modes, and you can actually get a little bit of pyritization as well.
Oh, okay, cool. So that would be like a beautiful kind of like fool's gold, very glamorous.
I hope look. So. I think it mostly just makes them a little red.
Oh, I guess so. Being Australia, red rocks. Okay, so yeah, mouth on the underside, and then they have got antennae as well? No.
Some of them. It's possible that most of them did, and it just doesn't fossilize.
It breaks off, yeah.
We do find it sometimes in the fossil record. Yeah. But again, it's a case of like, with appendages and trilobites, you're looking at maybe 50 or less samples where we actually have that.
And yeah, they've kind of got, I guess, a head shield.
Yes.
If you were to draw it, it'd be like a crescent moon with the points facing down. And then, yeah, you've got these segments, tri-lobe, like three lobes. That's, I think, what their name means.
Yeah. And then you have the butt end of the trilobite can take many forms.
Okay.
But
like you said before, someone has a really long, pointy, skinny bun.
Yes.
Is it Pygidia?
Yes. Okay. So with trilobites, they have that face shield. Usually that's kind of like a capital D shape. That's where the eyes are. That's where the glabella is. And that's where these spines that come off that make that crescent shape are as well. And we call those genal spines. The genal spines, the glabella, the shape and position of the eyes, that's all the stuff that we usually use to figure out what species. So that's all the really diagnostic stuff. And then the pygidium as well can be used diagnostically too, because they come in a lot of unique shapes and sizes. With Astangia, my model sample, the pygidium actually has this partition at the very bottom. It kind of makes like a little capital B.
Oh.
And that's why it's bilobata. we call it its frog butt. It's great.
Well, yeah, that's a very distinct butt.
Yeah. When it comes to trilobite research, a lot of people either don't have those middle sections, the axial lobes, because they disarticulate.
Like the midsection, like if it was an insect, you'd call it a thorax.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. We still call it a thorax.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah. So the thorax of the trilobite is the part that when they die is most likely to start disarticulating because...
Oh, it has all these partitions.
Yeah.
It's like when you have a notebook and you have that paper with the things so you can rip out the page easy.
Yeah, okay. Absolutely. So if you're in a location that would have been high energy during the animal's life, or there's a lot of predation or scavenging, you're just getting the top and the bottom. You don't really get the middle. And because the middle section is usually not diagnostic, it's something that for a long time, trilobite researchers haven't been particularly interested in.
Yeah. And maybe not collecting for that reason too.
Yeah. So now there have been so many revelations over the past 20, 30 years by people like Fusco and my supervisor, James Holmes, Diego at South Australia Museum, and Melanie Hopkins as well, where they're trying to look at these complete samples or samples where they do have the axial bits and say, okay, this is still helpful. Even if it can't tell us what species this is, we can learn more about how the animal's growing and those patterns that are dictating it.
With predation and stuff, we have touched on this before. What is the meaty part of the trilobite? Like, what bits tend to get chomped on more than others? Or is there like no pattern?
Well, there's a couple of researchers that look at trilobite predation in more detail than me, so I'm not totally sure.
Okay.
I would say they're about as meaty as like a horseshoe crab. There's not a lot of good pickings.
Yeah. You probably want to flip them over or something.
You want to flip them so that middle section kind of, it has like this little lip that wraps around and then you get all the little leggies. And there would have been muscles kind of controlling the way that the little legs moved. I'd imagine that would have been the tastiest bit of the trilobite to eat, along with whatever the guts are doing. And the guts kind of ran through that axial segment as well. But again, I think it would have been easier to get at from the underside.
So that kind of sums up form pretty nicely. And then, yeah, function and stuff. They make up a huge biomass in the ocean too. But then like on the individual level, they're rolling up into balls, I guess, to try and protect themselves from getting chomped on. Or is that to try and stop something like big grabbing them? Like,
it's hard to say because we don't know a lot about the predator-prey interactions in these ecosystems. But enrollment is something that we feel plays a really important role in a lot of different life stages for the trilobite. So when they need to molt, a lot of these guys need to actually escape that really hard exoskeleton and emerge with all their new segments.
Yeah. Does it normally crack and bust open on their backside and then they kind of emerge from it, or?
We get like a couple examples of them halfway out, but it's.
And they fossilize then.
Sometimes.
Ooh.
But it's again.
Unlucky, but very interesting.
Pants down. Sorry, buddy. So we know that they had components to their cephalon that would break off when they would molt. So the genal spines would disarticulate along these sutures, so they would pop open like that. Mm-hmm. And then they would occasionally have suture lines around the eyes and other portions of the face. So it's possible that coming out from the head end is likely.
I guess that makes sense because you want to see what you're doing. You don't want to have your vision obscured by like dead skin.
Yeah. But it's a case as well where in order to get out, they would have needed to contort the rest of the exoskeleton and flex it to escape like a hatchling.
Yeah.
And that's where the inhibitory cascade we kind of think might be coming in. So the idea is that if you don't have a lot of segments, but you need to kind of curl to escape, you want the segments you do have to be a bit bigger. So when they reach their full adult complement of segments, which could be anywhere between 10 and 50...
That was 50.
Yeah.
Not 15.
No.
50.
I would hate to be the guy counting them all.
Oh, someone's got to do it.
But then they don't need the segments to be as big because they can kind of curl a little bit more efficiently. Like if you think about it, like a slinky. Then they can kind of escape. But enrollment could have done lots of things. It could have been a protective feature. Another additional little fun tidbit with trilobites and enrollment is that as you start to see them getting larger, there are some intermediate juvenile stages where they actually develop these spines on the sides of the axial lobes called the pleura.
Mm.
These are called megapleural spines, and we don't really know what they were for, but recent theories by a couple of different researchers I've already mentioned suggest that these spines actually might have anchored the trilobite, like they could have pushed down into the sediment and use that as an anchor while they escaped.
Oh, wait, but then you said like juveniles have it, but then do adults lose them?
At least with Astangia and some of the other
species. Oh my gosh, they have a punk. They go through their teenage punk phase. Hell yeah.
They do. Oh, maybe they were hanging out with Lucigenia.
Oh, that's sick.
Yeah.
Okay, that's really interesting as well to modify your body for anchoring into the sediment, especially for animals that do have legs, aren't sessile, like they're not planting down and camping and being like, this is where I'm going to live for the rest of my life. No, they're going around, they're getting stuff in their environment, finding mates and stuff too. But
I just think it's fascinating how many of these like spiny adaptations that we've seen over the last couple of decades get revised as not like defensive structures, but as things that are helping the animal with other aspects of their life. I mean, I think you get that a little bit with some of the dinosaur anatomy.
Oh, yeah. Running joke. It's like maybe species recognition. It's maybe sexual display, like trying to show off. Or it's thermoregulation sometimes, like spines and stuff. But it's all just it's a combination of all, which is kind of just shorthand for we don't know. We're guessing.
I would say that's one of the components of paleo that's really enticing, though, is there's so much creativity in it.
And like the mystery as well of, okay, we're not going to see these animals in real life too. So what tools do we have at our disposal to really figure out how we're living their lives?
I mean, I love a good detective story, but my favorite thing about paleo at the moment is how ingenious some of the researchers will be in looking at different methods for studying different things in different fields. Like,
oh, you have this nice software for engineering? Let me borrow that so I can study sauropod limbs or
dental tools for excavation.
Yep. The medical beam line at the Australian Synchrotron.
Yes.
We'll just use that to scan our fossils. Please and thank you. Yeah, there's heaps of different examples too. Dragonfly, blender.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And especially with the Cambrian, it kind of feels like we have so little to go on and we have so few modern analogs that we really are trying to push methodology as hard as we can to make these determinations. And a lot of the new stuff that's coming out about trilobite functional anatomy or trilobite morphology, it utilizes all of this amazing technology, like 3D printing of models to determine finite element analysis of stress, those sorts of things. It's a really exciting time to be in the field because you just never know when somebody's going to come up with a new wacky way of looking at a bug from 500 million years ago.
Yeah. And that's another great thing too. Like those specimens have been sitting in museum collections for ages. It still has application. It's still really useful. And it's great that it has been looked after for all these years because as the technology gets better, we can learn more about it.
Yeah. And with Australia especially, it's such a treasure trove because we're really coming into this era where there's so many up and coming young people that are interested in paleo, not just as academics, but as volunteers. And we have more of this manpower in addition to the technology to kind of go through these collections. It's a really exciting time to look at bugs.
Yeah. Speaking of bugs, with trilobites, you've mentioned that some of the groupings and stuff, it's kind of hard to work out who's who in the zoo. Is that because they all kind of pop up in the fossil record at about the same time? Or it's easy to work out, okay, yeah, this is a trilobite, not a radiodont, for example, but you need to really look at it like under the microscope to work out some stuff? Or
I mean, yeah, part of it is that you have this massive trilobite radiation almost at the same time as you start seeing them, which is
typical for Cambrian.
I know.
It's called, I was going to say the explosion of life. That's not it.
The Cambrian explosion?
That's the one.
Yeah. It's a great time. It sounded like a cool party. I wish I could have been there. Although the ocean would have been probably quite disgusting by our standards. A bit of a horrible sangria. But anyway.
Probably had less plastic in it though.
Yeah. Yeah. Fewer sharks. No sharks, really.
No sharks.
Just horrible giant bugs. But with trilobites, from the first appearances that you see them, they've got these complex digestive systems. They've got these complex arrangements of limbs. So it's hard to point to what would be the progenitor for this group. And then because they aren't truly analogous to any modern group, right? There's no...
Yeah, they don't have any living descendants.
No, and it's actually considered its own subphyla within Arthropoda.
That's a big order in terms of the ranking and stuff of King Philip comes over for great soup, like kingdom, phylum, fill in the rest.
Yeah.
Phylum's a big group.
Yeah, it's huge. And it's partially because it's so hard to determine what they were doing and how they compare to one another. So, for example, we have these
and
other
20,000 species plus. I'm sure there's going to be more. Like Patrick Smith, he named, what, I don't know, 10 this year alone? There'll be more, I'm guessing.
Yeah, and in collections as well, like going back through and checking things out. Because, you know, before we had better methods of globally correlating certain stratigraphic sections, you know, you would have a researcher looking at a Cambrian deposit in the Czech Republic saying, oh, yes, this is definitely this thing. Is it? Is it a global distribution or a partial global distribution is something we would get in, say, China, a country that didn't necessarily have the same trilobite output until relatively recently, or at least a system where the two groups aren't really able to talk to one another.
And then, on that note as well, because Anomalocaris is known from Australia and China.
Yes.
So, if you didn't have internet as well at the time, it'd be really hard to keep up to date with like what fossils are being found in another country. And depending on whether their journals are written in English, or you got to whack it in Google Translate or pre-Google Translate days.
So there's this, one of my favorite examples of that is to do with an early group of jawless fish called thelodonts. And they look hilarious. Please look up a picture of a thelodont later. They look like they're always screaming and very surprised. And they're
what a mood.
Oh, I know. They are usually found in Silurian, Ordovician, I think maybe Devonian deposits, but they were found primarily in locations around Northern Europe. And during the time when they were starting to get out the really incredible, partially complete samples from Estonia and from Scotland, the two countries were not speaking because of the Soviet bloc. So there was a massive amount of research that was being done in both countries on really similar groups, but they were completely unable to share that information until after the USSR fell. And then when the information exchange began again, there was all this fuss to start getting things translated from Estonian, a language that a lot of people in the UK didn't really read. And when they finally were able to put their findings together, it was this incredible, much more complete idea of what these fish were doing. And it's so cool. It gives me goosebumps.
The take-home message.
Yes.
Pay attention to other languages. Pay attention to like research coming out of other countries and stuff too.
Yeah.
Because you never know.
And with trilobites, with the first couple of appearances of them, because you don't get globally distributed species until a certain point in a lineage, right? Like there have to be enough of it and it has to be doing well enough that it can get around.
Yeah. As a musician, you can't do a global tour until, you know, you start to get the home crowd behind you.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure Taylor Swift started out with a garage band at some point. So with trilobites, they're useful after a certain point for like correlating different sedimentary beds and saying different things about how the groups relate to each other. But it's so hard to figure out where that story starts.
So still a lot of stuff to do in terms of that. And then they're so their own thing if they're in their own subphylum.
Yeah.
Just about like that's absolutely bonkers.
Yeah. So essentially they are so distinct from your chelicerates, your crustaceans, your hexapods, and your myriapods, so centipedes, millipedes, that they're doing their own thing.
I should have asked this before. Do they have gills?
So there are some specimens we found that have these structures on, I want to say, some of the first parts of the axial lobes that are
like near the head.
Yeah, that are somewhere between like a gill and something that a lot of insects have called a book lung.
Oh, interesting. Okay. I guess the reason why I wanted to ask is because, yeah, they only lived in the oceans.
Yeah.
They didn't get into fresh water and they definitely didn't make it onto land.
No.
But they need to breathe still. So they are somehow getting oxygen out of the water and, you know, doing their thing. But in terms of the how, again, like as you pointed out, the crunchy outer layer, the delicious exoskeleton is being preserved, but like the goo is gone.
Most of the goo, presumably. You, listener, could be the goo finder in the museum.
Yeah. If you see like gunk that looks kind of off, but it looks like it's part of a fossil, don't prepare it away. Maybe just see if you can suss things out, because there is like soft tissue preservation in Burgess Shale.
Yeah.
Which is a Cambrian, very famous Cambrian age deposit. Is there anything else you want to add for like form, function, or family groupings of trilobites, or some favorites that you wanted to mention?
So with trilobites, it's a case where people imagine them as a completely separate group all the way from the beginning that didn't have analogs even in their time. It's true that we don't have modern analogs to trilobites now, but during the Cambrian, there are all these other bug-like animals, other archaeopods that look like trilobites and probably have some relation to them, but just weren't as successful. So one of the things with Cambrian research is ever since like the 1980s and the fantastic book by Stephen Jay Gould, Wonderful Life, came out, there's been this element with the Cambrian of these things are so unique and they're so unlike anything we've ever seen. They're so mysterious. And that's still true. But even during the time when they were alive, they were still living animals and they were still animals that had relatives, that had families, and relatives in the geologic and paleontological sense, not in the sense of sharing a birthday.
Yeah, or aunts or uncles and cousins and stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's entirely possible that the more we learn about these groups that aren't trilobites but look like them, the more we could start to say about how trilobites are evolving as well.
Awesome. Well, we have been chatting for a long time. It is coming up to lunch. Before we wrap up, I also do like to talk about trilobites in pop culture. I like to talk about fossils in pop culture and stuff. Trilobites, as you said before, have been something that humans have been aware of for quite a while, definitely in collections since the 1800s. Can you think of any favorite trilobites in pop culture?
I love the Pokemon Trilobite and Anomalocaris analogs a whole lot. Those are probably my favorites.
Yeah. So there's Anorith.
Yes.
Which is the Anomalocaris one. What's the Trilobite one? Oh, it's a new one.
Yeah.
Is it Wimpod or something?
I wish I remembered the name. I'm a fake fan. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. I only know this one because of Pokemon Go and I actually uninstalled it this morning being like, I haven't played this since I've been in Melbourne. Get rid of this. I'm going to say Wimpod. But I'm not sure. And then is Carbito and Carbotops kind of like they're trilobite adjacent?
Yeah.
Or are they meant to be more horseshoe crabs?
So my understanding from my time teaching students is that when most Japanese general public members consider the term kaseki or fossil, they're thinking about a trilobite or an ammonite. And I think this was an attempt to talk about like the generic idea of this is a bug fossil. I mean, I don't know for sure. I'd not read developer notes, but I do think it's probably like a cross between a trilobite and a horseshoe crab.
Yeah. Carbotops is just kind of weird again because he's got legs and then these scythe-like arms, but then it's like ripped as well. Like the body segments are like, I don't know, a 20 pack? It's nuts.
So fossil record trilobites not ripped, did not have that level of stackedness.
I mean, if they can like curl up a lot though, they've probably got better abs than I do. You can't think of any like movies or TV shows that would have trilobites. Oh, there's a trilobite yaoi. There's definitely at least one trilobite yaoi. Yep.
Yeah. And I would say just for the general vibe that the trilobite brings to your table. There's a great movie called Ponyo that brings in.
Oh, yeah. Opening like 10 minutes. It like kind of shows all kinds of life.
Yeah. I don't know if there's actually specifically a trilobite in there. But
I'm going to say yes, because I would screenshot and be like, how do I make my creative stuff look like this? Because it's so, it's just a sensory explosion. Yeah. Of like, and everything's like moving around and stuff.
Yeah.
There's definitely got to be some trilobites in there. I think there's Eurypterids in there too.
Yeah, there's Eurypterids. There's a coelacanth. There's some placoderms. It's an exciting little movie for people who like the animals from before the Mesozoic.
Yeah. Awesome. And then if people want to follow on with your work, like where can they find you?
Sure. I'm on Instagram. I'm on X.
Used to be Twitter.
I still want to call it Twitter.
I still call it Twitter.
Yeah. So I,
and because I know it'll piss off the person who owns that platform.
Which is good. We should do that. Yes. Yeah. So I'm on Twitter as well. And it's the same name. So it's SLYSSABITS. So Slysabits.
Awesome.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, you also do like a bit of outreach works too. So some people have had the pleasure of having you on Skype a Scientist.
Yeah. I do Skype a Scientist and I've done a couple of other volunteer things throughout the years. I like doing pub talks and
What is it called?
Pint of Science.
Pint of Science.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep, you did that this year as well.
Yeah.
With some of the other folks from Monash.
Yeah. Jake was on board. Ben Francis Shelley was there.
Oh, awesome.
And I had to go before him. So it was just very like, ugh, okay, well, I'll be this.
Ben is really hard to top and he's always been so charismatic.
Absolutely. But yeah, no, I think outreach is something really important. And it's something that I think for invertebrate paleontologists might not seem like a straightforward thing that we could or should do.
But well, there's that meme as well where the parents got like they're holding up one kid is drowning. Yeah. And I think the way the paleontology community has appropriated it is like, it's either T-Rex or like vertebrate paleontology is being held up, inverts are drowning, and then the skeleton at the bottom of the ocean in the chair is paleobotany.
Yeah.
Is kind of how it goes. And like the media is responsible for this as well.
It is.
But this is also something we need to be aware of and course correct for.
I genuinely feel like it is a misunderstanding by the media about people's curiosity, right? Mm. Like, I've never really met anybody who is just a general member of the public who's ever gone, oh, bugs, no, I don't care. If they've taken time out of their day to learn about what you do, they're curious. You don't have to sell them so hard on something that's not a T-Rex. You just have to treat them with respect and acknowledge that most of the time, if they're talking with you about an invertebrate fossil, it's probably because it's the fossils that are around them.
Yes, absolutely.
And I think it's, at the end of the day, it really is about making sure that members of that community are empowered with what we know and what we understand to maintain that preservation and take care of those fossils.
Yeah, like full circle moment. Like you said at the start, like you're kind of on this journey because you would find stuff in nature when you were a kid and you've just kind of followed that to this point here.
Yeah. So,
yeah, that's really awesome.
And that's what I want to encourage anybody listening to do is if you're somebody who's keen on fossils or you're seeing stuff in your natural environment that's interesting to you, you don't have to do academia. You don't have to be in the same position that I'm in or follow the journey I followed, but stay interested. Talk to people, talk to local scientists, and find out what you can do to take care of what's in your backyard.
Alyssa, thank you so much for not only taking time to teach us about trilobites, but also sharing your story. So many important takeaways during our chat, but the big one for me is the perfect grades aren't the be-all and end-all, and you can still pursue paleontology. This episode was recorded with assistance from the Conservation Department at Museums Victoria. Shout outs to Tim Ziegler from the Paleo Department and Lizzie for making it all happen. Normally, this is the part of the episode where I list out museums where you can find the fossils we've been talking about. But since we've been talking about a whole subphylum, I'm not even going to try, but you can absolutely tag me in your trilobite photos. You love to see it. Our intro music is by the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles of pop punk Hello Kelly, who are on hiatus at the moment, but their tunes are still up on Spotify and all the places like that, so just search for Hello Kelly. And if you're obsessed with Hello Kelly like I am, the lead singer Francie also has his solo stuff on Spotify. And to find that, just search for Francie Planet. Speaking of Francie, the podcast literally wouldn't be what it is today without him. He edits the show and helps out with a bunch of other stuff, so thanks again. The Pals in Paleo podcast cover art is made by graphic designer and illustrator Jenny Zhao, who co-founded Crumpet Club, a collective of freelance designers. You can find her work at Jenny Z Design on Instagram, and Crumpet Club is at Crumpet Club House on Instagram. Thanks so much for listening and going back in time with us today to talk about trilobites. If you're driving, drive safe. But if you're prepping fossils right now as you're listening, just know I'm super jealous. Pals in Paleo will be back soon with fresh facts on old fossils. But until we speak again, stay curious and just keep digging.